Well, we're far enough into the summer season to know the difference between a hot day and a hot day made worse by humidity, all without looking at the thermometer. That's a difference that is known in weather terms as the heat index. I'm Larry Mueller. Two guests, our weather guys back with us once again, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, good to have you back.
Yes, Larry, it's good to be back on a rather cooler day, at least with the heat index, compared to this weekend.
John Martin, not sweating as much either, professor and former chair of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Department at UW-Madison. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here. But don't get me wrong, I'm always sweating something.
Well, I want to talk today about some of these weather terms, heat index, heat wave, and we'll also learn about record-breaking lightning strike and some Wisconsin tornadoes. And so there's lots to talk about. And as you listen to these two guys, I hope you'll join in with your own weather questions and observations. What have you noticed about the weather around you lately? Any questions about severe weather? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. You also could send a photo. We'd love to see if you got some cool lightning or if you got a cool weather cloud photo. We'd love to see that as well. You can send that to ideas@wpr.org, and we'd certainly love to see them. Well, we've been having a lot of hot weather, summer weather lately. What exactly qualifies something to be called a heat wave? Is there an actual definition of that?
So there is an actual definition. You know, in words, it's a period of abnormally and uncomfortably hot and unusually humid weather. So those descriptive words are not very mathematical or tight, if you will. And so the World Meteorological Organization, which the U.S. belongs to, all the or nearly all of the countries belong to this. And one thing they do is keep records and then also make definitions. And so they define a heat wave as a time when the daily maximum temperature for more than 5 days in a row exceeds the average maximum temperature by 9 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's the World Meteorological Organization technical definition of a heat wave.
9 degrees, that's a lot.
It is.
Yeah, John. 5 days is a long time. So that, you know, that's a stringent criteria.
Go ahead, John, sorry.
But it's nicely quantitative, as Steve is pointing out. I think it's you gotta get past vague descriptive words and try and put some quantity on it. And I think that's a pretty decent quantitative description, though it does mean that what we just had over the weekend doesn't even come close to qualifying as a heat wave.
Although a lot of people have called it
after getting through it.
Yeah. Well, what you know, you look at the weather for the week, or you're wondering how hot it is outside. There's something that says it feels like, usually next to the actual temperature, and that's, I guess, the heat index.
Yeah.
And what impacts that? What impacts that?
Well, the humidity is a big factor in the heat index because it's trying to give you an impression of what would it be like if you simply had the air temperature with sort of a regular in the house relative humidity, something in the 30% range or something. How overheated would you likely be, you know, would you feel given really hot temperatures but not high humidity? The problem with the humidity is for human comfort is that if it's very humid, if the air is filled with water vapor, it's very hard for you to perspire. So you can't cool yourself down by the natural perspiration method that, you know, your body has evolved to have. And so the more humidity, the hotter it is to get yourself cooled off on a hot day. If, on the other hand, the air is quite dry and therefore there's plenty of room for water vapor molecules to evaporate from the liquid phase, some of those vapor molecules can come right from your skin. You're perspiring at your body's temperature, and the act of evaporating that liquid water off your skin actually serves as a cooling mechanism for your otherwise overheated body. So it's a great evolutionary adjustment, but it is dependent on atmospheric conditions to work. Some days they don't work.
So if you had, you could have a heat index that's higher than the temperature itself, right?
That will always be the case, in fact.
That will always be the case.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes some sense, I guess. Marcus in Green Bay has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Marcus.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
Yeah, I have two topics. One is there's been a couple of magnificent rainbows in my area, and many people have seen it and photographed it. And then the other one is these great sunsets that have been happening. Do they have anything to do with the dust storms in the Sahara Desert, bringing up dust particles? Or is that just false? Great sunsets. So yeah. The comment on those things.
There was a nice one last night, actually, here in the Madison area. A comment on those. Steve, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, we had some heavy rains all through southern Wisconsin, I think. And boy, I know at my house we had like 1.8 inches of rain. And then it clears out. And then there are tons of photos on Facebook and other places of the rainbows over the area. So it's that timing to get that rainbow to form. You need to have the right angle between where the sun is, where the raindrops are falling, and where your eye is. And since those storms have been occurring late in the afternoon, late in the afternoon, the sun's low enough that we're getting these spectacular rainbows. And the other thing is that also at my house, there was the rainbow, and then at sunset, it was also a gorgeous sunset because there were a lot of high clouds around. And the clouds can give you really gorgeous sunsets. In the more recent cases, it's not the dust from the from the Sahara that we had back in June, I think that was, because most of that dust or all of it has already been washed out of the atmosphere by rain and things like that. So dust can give you very reddish types of sunsets, but the ones we've been having recently are after a rain, and the rain would wash that dust out, and so you wouldn't see. It wouldn't be a cause for the gorgeous sunsets we've been having recently.
Yeah, and I would just add that I think we've had an unusually high number of those just before sunset, you know, illuminated skies, like you were just talking about, Steve. Even aside from rainbows, the underside of the higher clouds that are left on the backside of a line of severe weather or thunderstorm activity, we've had at least half a dozen of them this summer. It's been an exceptionally high number, and that is a function purely of timing. Because people in Milwaukee probably didn't get that. They're just another hour away. And then, you know, if the clouds don't get there on time before the sun's below the horizon, you're not going to get that. So we've been really lucky here in the southern central part of the state.
Yeah, they've been beautiful sunset.
Really,
yeah. It was like the sky was almost yellow gold last night.
Yeah, and it glows, the whole thing. The whole dome glows like that for a while. And we just power washed the side of our house, which has got white vinyl siding and long overdue. But nonetheless, the yellow and gold that you're talking about, Larry, reflects off of that. And it was just like we had lights on outside on the driveway. And it was unbelievable. And we've had that a few times this summer.
Oh, man, that's cool. I was in the house doing something, and I just sort of glanced out, and I saw that, and I walked outside because I saw the yellow gold, you know, coloring in the air. And when I walked out, I looked up and down the street, and there were quite a few people, you know, a few neighbors who were also had been sort of noticed and went out to look. It was really fantastic. Jim from East Troy emailed. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to add, and you need those high clouds to see those colors because normally without the clouds there, that yellow orange light is heading on its way out to space. And it hits those high clouds and then scatters around and illuminates the sky.
Yeah, it's just really something. Jim emailed from East Troy. Do we know what causes an area of no precipitation to form behind an approaching uniform front trailed by an area of uniform rainfall? He says that happened yesterday. It seems like it's happened before. The front approach is looking promising on radar. It breaks up on a line from approximately Elkhorn to Sullivan and then fills back in to the east. It's extremely dry where he's at, to the point of significant crop yield loss. Yet just to the east in Waterford, they've had more than enough rain all season.
Very interesting, yeah. It's hard to know exactly what set of circumstances might conspire to make this a repeated offense for, you know, for the Elkhorn area. Part of it can be the lake breeze off of Lake Michigan coming in at the right or the wrong time of day. That might explain the regeneration of some of the thunderstorms to the east, a little closer to the lake, because later in the day, the lake breeze is probably at its strongest. And so it's going to be really hard for thunderstorms to develop to the west of that. If they've already decayed, they won't redevelop there. They'll redevelop at the lakefront breeze, the lake breeze front, sorry, which is further east than Elkhorn. There may also be hills involved, some complex topography and interactions the topography has with the incoming line of thunderstorms can wreak havoc on their ability to sustain themselves. And it's also the lakes region of the state. So the surface is probably not as heated on a hot day over that southeast part of the state than it is, say, over the south-central part of the state, where it's more or less cropland or just vegetated land that makes a big difference. So there's a whole bunch of things that's hard to put your finger on any one or which combination of them might be the culprit, but there's a whole bunch of sensitive circumstances that are at play every time.
Really interesting. Joe in Madison, question?
Yeah, a couple of times in my life I've experienced the perfect snowflake coming down, and I'm just wondering what conditions are needed for perfect, you know, the six-pointed snowflakes to get to the ground. And then are all snowflakes first formed as perfect snowflakes and then they change as they come down, or how does that work?
Ah, well, I tell you what. That's a really good question, and we're going to hang on to that question, and we'll answer it after we take a look at the news and find out all the things that are in store for us on the Ideas Network. Our guests today, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, are weather guys. They come by once a month, the last Monday of the month, to talk with us, and they'll be with us right up until 12:30. So we'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin, both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and always great to have them come by. Steve is also Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison as well. Questions for them, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a cool weather photo, send that along as well. Love to see it. We had Joe in Madison with a couple of questions relating to snowflakes. What conditions are needed for perfect snowflakes? And then he wonders, do they start perfect and then maybe change as they develop?
Yeah, so I'm going to first distinguish between a snowflake and a snow crystal. So a snow crystal is a single crystal of ice, and a snowflake is a general term that people, you know, sometimes use for a snow crystal, but usually it's snow crystals that have gotten stuck together. So an agglomeration of snow crystals. And so I wanted to make that distinction because when we think of the formation of a single snow crystal, the shape that it takes on is going to be a function of the temperature and the amount of water vapor that's in the air or the environment in which it is growing. So that temperature and what we call the supersaturation rate will tell you whether or not you're going to get plates or columns or needles or dendritic structures. And as that temperature and humidity of the environment change, as the crystal falls through the environment, then the shape will take on a different shape. So it may start out as a six-sided flat plate, but then if it falls into an environment where needles are favored for growth, then at each one of those little six apexes, a needle form will start to grow. And then if it falls into another environment with a different shape, then that shape will begin to take on. Now, when I think about really nice, beautiful single crystals that I've seen in the wintertime, if you think about it, it's generally a very calm wind. So they get to just float and fall down and maintain their shape. And once you get some winds or turbulence, then they start colliding together and either sticking or breaking up and don't take on that beautiful shape. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. And speaking of wind, I think Jim in Reedsburg has a question relating to wind, I believe. Jim, are you there? Jim, oh, maybe we lost Jim in Reedsburg. He wonders, what are straight line winds?
Those are straight line winds can do some real damage to property, almost as much as you get damage done by tornadoes. And the difference between a straight line wind event that does damage and a tornadic event that does damage is there's absolutely no rotation at all to the straight line wind event. So it's just like a freight train with infinite distance across its front edge, it just comes roaring through a location. Very little spinning around of the winds at all. Just straightforward brute force, blowing things down, ripping shingles off roofs and stuff like that. And it's because of the reason that straight line winds might be the means or the way in which the high winds are going to be communicated to the ground, as opposed to a tornado, has something to do with the thunderstorm environment in which the winds are being generated. So there's differences there that account for the difference between tornadic strong winds and straight line strong winds.
Man, they're blowing pretty hard. To get a straight line wind, well, how fast are they? What's the speed of a straight line wind?
I think I've heard of cases, and have them a lot in Minnesota, the northern part of our own state, right around this time of year. I think they're on the order of 100, 120 mile per hour easily in cases that are strong. So they don't have the same velocity as the extreme winds in a tornado, really strong tornado. But they have the advantage, which is, not such a good thing to tout. They have the advantage of being able to cover a much wider area with potential damage at 120 mile per hour, 100 mile per hour winds.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned tornadoes. Brad sent us an email and wondered if tornadoes always spin in the same direction, and is it clockwise or counterclockwise?
Yeah, it's not always the same direction. I think there's a preference in the Northern Hemisphere for counterclockwise rotating vortices that manifest themselves as tornadoes, but it is absolutely true that any kind can occur. I think the ratio, Steve, is the ratio like 90% clockwise, counterclockwise to 10% clockwise or something like that? Is that an estimate you've heard?
Yeah, I think that's the estimate that I've heard too. And the Coriolis force is going to make it get that rotation-wise, and they're small scale. And so Coriolis force really doesn't come into play at the tornado level.
Bill in Elm Grove, Wisconsin, has a question for you. Let's go there.
Hi there, Larry.
Hi, Bill.
Listen, I have a question. you hear people saying, well, when it's hot and humidity, oh, it's the humidity. But I've also heard people say when it's cold, and they say, well, it's dry, so it doesn't feel so cold. So how could that be true?
All right. It's not. That's how, because it's not. But the first part, though, about when it's hot and humid, it's worse than just being hot. And we did talk about that a little bit before. And that the presence of the water vapor, which makes it humid in the air on a hot, humid day like yesterday or Saturday, that prevents your body from being able to cool down by perspiration. And that makes you feel miserable. And in extreme cases, you overheat, have some real problems, physical problems. In the wintertime, the background humidity of the air is so low anyway that it makes almost no difference what its small variation might be on a really cold day. You're just going to be cold, and it has nothing at all to do with how much water vapor is in the air. So,
because the water vapor is already at what percent? 20%? 25?
Probably less than 20. Probably less than 5 on the really coldest days. When you really get that Fabrique au Canada air that comes down off the pole, you're excited about that if you're me. But there's no water in that at all. It's been completely desiccated. So it's really bone dry.
Oh, interesting. Bill, thank you. Dave, go ahead, Steve.
In the wintertime, we get more concerned about the wind and how that makes you feel with regard to a temperature, because the wind makes you cool down faster. So it seems colder than what it actually is.
Yeah, that makes sense. David in Menominee Falls, your turn. Hi, David.
Hello, how are we doing today?
Good, appreciate the call.
Well, I have a question about a form of precipitation. Good thing you're talking about winter. Graupel.
Mm.
You guys familiar with that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What sort of conditions form that as opposed to regular snowfall, and how common is it?
So, John, tell us what it is first and then answer David's question.
I bet Steve's going to know more about it than me, but I'll try.
Okay.
Graupel is frozen. It's in a conglomerate of frozen precipitation that has kind of been maybe started out as a snowflake buried down deep under this conglomerate of other pieces of ice that have accreted on top of it. Sometimes the ice is quite soft because it's only barely below freezing when it does turn to ice. And so it's not quite hail because it's not formed by the same mechanisms as hail, which is a continuous recirculation of the stone itself through a thunderstorm. That's not what happens with graupel. But graupel is just a mixed form of precipitation, mostly ice that can fall in the wintertime. And as the caller seems to suggest, it's really true. It won't always happen. So it only is going to happen in a location if you're kind of straddling either at the surface, the freezing line, or somewhere up above you where you might be surprised that the temperature is actually warmer well above your head than it is at the ground, and you're wondering why water-coated pieces of ice are falling on your head and the temperature is 25 degrees, because the temperature a mile above might be 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So there's all manner of different circumstances that can lead to the production of graupel. Does that sound reasonable, Steve, or I'm sure I missed something?
I would do the same thing. They're just soft. Small pellets formed by super cool water droplets, and a lot of time it's accretion, as you're saying, so water vapor that's in the atmosphere kind of sticking to them. I was wondering about the frequency of occurrence in which we observe it on the ground anyway. And I don't think it occurs that often, and I'm doing that purely on anecdotal evidence, but I like it. It's a cool word. If you play Scrabble, it's a great word to use to get challenged if you play really serious Scrabble. It's not hail. It is soft. When it hits, it'll break up. But, yeah, if you want to, brag about your weather knowledge, when you do have graupel and somebody says, oh, it's snowing, or somebody says it's hailing, you could say, no, that's graupel.
Yeah, graupel, yeah. Snow grains do seem like a cousin of it, and they seem to be all snow, but I suppose under the microscope, are they in the graupel family, or are they by themselves? Do you know? Because I don't know that.
I think they're by themselves, and I think they're more like spherical, triangular, or not what's a 3D triangle called?
A dodecahedron or something like that. A hedron,
yeah,
something, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So they have a different shape, whereas Grapple is more roundish, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, now for the gamers, how do you spell Grapple?
G R A U P E L. I have to write that out.
Grapple. Okay. Well, I gotta remember that.
Look it up, Larry. Steve's a pretty competitive Scrabble player. He might have just sandbagged you. I'm not sure. just a caution.
I like Scrabble. Grapple would be. I could see that turning up in a Scrabble game. Yeah, for sure. All right, there we go. Lori in Hale's Corners, your turn. Hi, Lori.
Yes, hi. I'm hoping you have some insights for me. We spent a winter in Texas. Galveston and nearby is Texas City. And what is that over there? It's the processors. Oh, man, a whole bunch of we saw people coming out of work carrying their lunch buckets, and we're thinking, oh, my God, we're changing the kind of energy we're going to use, and all of this has to change. And do you have any insights? What's going to be the effect on the purity of our environment and the energy choices that we make, and we're heading in a new direction with cars running on this and that. Do you have and unemployment? Oh my gosh, what are your insights there?
Wow, Steve, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that far south Texas coast, they do a lot of petroleum refinery. Is that what you're referring to? Maybe.
Yes, the word I was looking for. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's. It's up close, it's pretty darn ugly. I think that's almost everybody would say that. It's, belching all kinds of dark smokes and various things, and it makes you wonder how can we even have anything like a clean atmosphere in the face of that. And in the short term, if it was only one plant working one day, it probably wouldn't do much damage. But this has, of course, gone on now on the order of, 100 years. So it's a serious threat. And, in fact, it underlies exactly what we all view as an existential threat of climate change. Hasn't gotten much attention in the last couple of months because of other more prominent threats, but it's still there and it's still got teeth and it's still really subtle. And we better reckon with it because of the very thing you're talking about. It's going to change the nature of our atmosphere, not only for how we breathe and how healthy it is we breathe, but it's going to change our climate. It already is. So we've got some problems there that we got to work on.
Yeah.
And I would add that, we do have people working on this. The Great Lakes Bioenergy Center is looking at alternative fuels, so we don't have to do the carbon-based ones. And, the other thing about the COVID-19 is, because industries have shut down or really reduced their output and people have really limited their driving, it has provided an experiment, and we are seeing an atmosphere that has some less pollutants associated with the burning of fossil fuels and things. So it's been kind of an interesting experiment from a meteorological point of view that probably would have been impossible to do in a coordinated event.
Yeah. Thank you again, Lori, for calling. Gary in Ween, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Larry. Love the show. Love the weather, guys. I have two comments. One in, I believe it was about 1976, the Phillips area in northern Wisconsin got hit by a straight-line wind. I think it was in July. And they had even had an article in Newsweek magazine, and I think that the wind speeds were like 180. It was just an unbelievable number. And the second comment was, in 2001, my wife and I were out east, and we went and climbed Mount Washington.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Eric Pinter wrote that book, Dying Down the Wind. Mm-hmm. And there they'd had at that time the fastest clocked straight-line wind. And the other part of this was it was like 4.5 miles up Timmerman Ravine to get to the summit. Mm-hmm. And when we got to the top, my wife found out she could have either driven up there or took the Cog Railroad, and I had to take her out to a nice Italian meal that night.
Yeah. You know, my great-great-grandfather built the Cog Railway up Mount Washington.
Oh.
How do you like that? At least he was part of the team. So, yeah, there's a whole bunch of ways to get up through from Timmermans Ravine up to the top. The problem is if you take your car, you better be careful of your brakes on the way down because the road is really steep. You see people stopped along the side pouring water on their discs to keep their brakes from going bad. So it's pretty serious, but it's a pretty amazing place to get up to the top of that mountain any time of year.
And there we had 108, Gary was saying 180-mile-an-hour straight-line winds, and that's possible.
Yeah, probably not in the thunderstorm environment. I'm wondering if that's probably, I know the ones on the top of Mount Washington were just, it was April 12th, 1934. It was just a day, you know, in the transition from winter to spring. It was a pretty energetic day. But it wasn't a thunderstormy day. But I'll accept those kinds of winds for these straight line winds. I've heard testimony that they ripped the paint off the side of a wall. So, I mean, that's got to be pretty strong to do that. So, yeah, I wouldn't doubt that they're in that range.
Gary, thanks again. Go ahead,
I think
Steve.
I think that was in 77, on July 4th, so Independence Day in 77, because that was one of the first derecho events that I remember reading and hearing about. That was up by Phillips, right? That's where they have that concrete park where they have the statues. Mm-hmm. All made it. Yeah, right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you again for calling, Gary. D in Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, D.
Hi. A few years ago, I live maybe 5 miles from Lake Mendota, and it was a very blustery day. And when I came home, there was a 4-inch silver fish in the snow. And I had looked it up, and there is something called raining fish. And I was wondering if you could speak to that, how often that happens. And
wow.
Wow, that's right. Raining fish there, Steve.
In winter, too? Is that what you said?
She said in winter.
It was late winter. Like, there was still snow on the ground, so maybe early spring, late winter.
Any ice on the lake? Was there still ice on the lake?
Yeah.
I don't think there's been ice on the lake for a while.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm wondering if you didn't just get something like, when we have these leaf devils or dust devils in the fall, when it gets windy and there's debris on the ground, it can kind of create these little rotating vortices that you notice and people get excited about them. They should. They're pretty cool natural phenomena. Small-scale tornadoes, although they form in a totally different way. But there is something about those kinds of vortices that could quite likely pull up a little minnow off. It was kind of at the top surface of the water, get it out of the water, and then deposit it just about anywhere else. First, it could go straight up into a cloud and reside there for a while before it falls back down. Who knows? So it's quite possible, but amazing nonetheless that kind of thing can happen. It's unbelievable.
You wonder what the minnow's thinking. You're swimming along and suddenly you're up in a cloud.
That's a 3-hour tour for a minnow.
Oh, man. Well, Gary from Iron River emailed a question. He said, we see weather reports specifying a percentage of or likelihood of rain. He's wondering if there are any lookbacks on those forecasts, comparing the actual rain events with the percentage forecast on an annual or multi-year basis. So does anybody go back and check on the...
Forecast verification is a major part of the forecasting enterprise, as you might guess. So people are paying attention to that. I'm not so sure that they have, that there's a particular emphasis on trying to verify the percentages, because when you come right down to it, it's binary. It either does precipitate on a forecasted location or it does not. You can't, nobody gets 70% precipitation. So you either get some or you don't. So I don't know how they deal with that subtlety, but verifying the forecast is a major, major part of the Weather Service forecast enterprise.
Yeah. Somebody wondered, red sky in morning, sailor take warning, red sky at night, sailor delight. Steve, you've said that's kind of true. In 10 yeah, seconds?
It is.
And it has to do with the sunset and the fact that in our region of the world, storm systems move from west to east.
All right. On that happy note, thanks, guys. You'll be back August 31st. We'll do this again. Steve and John, appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. Steve is also Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at the UW. They'll be back on the 31st. Thank you for listening. Hey, please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. Pet care on our minds tomorrow. But for now, stay with us. I'm Larry Mehler.